Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has one matter on its oral submission docket. That matter is Edgewood Independent School District and Others versus Lionel R. Minow and Others, a direct appeal from the 250th District Court of Travis County. The court has allotted 2 hours for oral argument in this cause. The argument will be broken into 6 segments, and the first 2 appellants, Edgewood ISD and Others, and Carrollton Farmers Branch ISD and Others, will lead off and will also be given time for rebuttal at the end. You may advise the marshal of the court of how much time you wish to reserve for rebuttal, and the lights will be so ordered. After we hear from all appellants, the court will take a brief recess. That should be at 1 hour and 5 minutes of the argument. Then we will come back and hear from appellees and from the rebuttal appellants. These arguments are being tape recorded for the convenience of the court, and you may make application with the clerk to listen to a tape of the argument if you desire to do so. The court is now ready to hear argument from Edgewood Independent School District and Others.
Mr. Kaufman and Ms. Johnson will present arguments for appellant Edgewood. Mr. Kaufman will open with the first 15 minutes. Appellants have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Al Kaufman. I'm an attorney with the Mexican American Legal Defense Fund. I represent the original plaintiffs in this case, Edgewood ISD et al. Also here on behalf of the plaintiff interveners, Alvarado ISD et al. Total of approximately 120 districts with about 600,000 students. I know that the court has read the briefs and understands the basic system. I want in my opening statement to cover 3 major points. The first is that the gap in Senate Bill 7 is much more than the $600 that you've read so much about. The gap will be significantly more than $600, and it will affect more than just the 15% of districts at the highest level of wealth. Secondly, even $600 per weighted student is a substantial difference in access to funds for comparable tax rates. In the context of Texas school finance in Texas school districts as they exist now and as we foresee as they will exist for the rest of the century. Next, Senate Bill 7 did not in any way cover the facilities problem or take care of the problem of financing facilities. And that affects not only the building of buildings, but the equipping of those buildings and the support for other programs in the schools. In terms of the gap in Senate Bill 7 this year will be from $29,000 in Lorellis ISD if they choose to be at a $1.37 tax rate, down to $3,000 in the lowest district. So the gap is not just $600. From the top to the bottom will be more like $26,000. Although that, again, the top district is a small one, you still have larger districts such as an Eanes or a Glen Rose with $7,000, $8,000, Glen Rose with $7,000, Eanes with $5,500. So there are still very substantial gaps allowed in this bill for this year.
When you compare that's the temporary provision.
That is the temporary provision, yes, sir.
The transition provision.
The transition provision, yes, sir. That will allow that side gap, yes, sir.
Has any real progress been made since this court's unanimous decision in the Edgewood 1 case?
Yes. I think progress has been made. We're very proud of that, and I think the court should be as well. I think we have reduced the gap long term, and we have considered more of the cost of education in the system. Both of those are very positive things. On the other hand, we've still failed to take care of facilities, we've still failed to finance the system correctly, and we've still left major gaps that will affect the education of students.
Mr. Kaufman, you're talking about the gap as being, I guess, one of your central points. Bear with me. People talk about Edgewood being a property poor school district. So I tend to be defining property poor as meaning that with a maximum tax effort, taxing property at the maximum lawful rate, and with the maximum contribution from state and federal funds, or rather the state contributions to the support of education, that Edgewood today is not able to meet the minimum educational needs of its children. Is that a correct definition of property poor?
No. Well, the statement is correct that they can't meet the needs of their students. As far as the definition of property poor, I think we have honestly not come up with an exact number. I think that we roughly use $100,000 of wealth and below as property poor. Some people use above that. But basically, it's a relative matter. All of the districts below 100,000 really can't do what they need to do.
What does that mean?
Well, what that means is they cannot provide the program for their students that they need, but also within the amount of money the state has available, they are at a significant disadvantage compared to other districts that have significantly more funds.
So critical to your argument is not really the minimum needs of the children. Critical to your argument is that the programming has to be generally the same throughout the state. Irrespective of establishing what the minimum needs are, the programming has to be similar throughout the state.
Yeah, irrespective of the minimum, it has to be the same throughout the state. Now, when you use the word programming, in this case, I think we have focused more on the funding that is accessible to the districts rather than the programming per se. But as we, the record shows, there's a strong relationship. Basically, far more funds, you can offer more programs. But I didn't want to...
So if you go to kind of an historical analysis, the state provides funding for the minimum educational needs of the children, and then you supplement that with local property taxes to do whatever the local district wants to do, the essence of your argument has nothing to do with the minimum. The essence of your argument says if one school district has funds available to do more than another district, then the state must have a mechanism to make sure that the district that is not capable of doing that has funds available to do that.
Yes, and that's been our position throughout the litigation, Your Honor, that we've avoided trying to define minimums. I think the testimony is that almost every district in the state is below the national average, and we don't, instead of, we're trying to avoid a definition of minimum, because what that would mean, Your Honor, is that our districts would get then the minimum, and other districts would have more than the minimum, no matter where you define it. And that's why we have stressed so hard that we have to use all of the state's resources to provide all students the same opportunity. And that's been our thrust throughout the litigation. We maintain that. We feel that the state has not yet met that standard.
Can you see the state ever meeting that standard? If the standard is that the poorest districts get what the wealthiest districts have in terms of per capita spending, will this litigation ever end?
Yes, it will. I think the state can do it, and therefore the litigation would end. I think that within the state's power, it has the power to create a system where literally every district in the state has the same access to funds at any tax rate available under the system. And that's our goal, and as I said, it has been from the beginning. The problem with the continuation of systems the state has designed is they continue the same problems. They still have had the lower wealth districts up to a certain level as defined by the state, and they still have allowed the wealthier districts to exceed that through their greater tax wealth. And that problem has not yet been solved here. I think it can be solved, yes, sir.
And indeed, as far as a way to solve the problem, the state did come up with a alternative which it approved and which Edgewood felt substantially complied with the requirement, didn't it? Wasn't that what Edgewood 3 was all about?
In Centerville 351, Your Honor, we never made a statement that we felt it substantially complied. We feel that Senate Bill 351 was significant progress. It's actually a better bill than this one, and this one also is progress. But the state has never come up with that complete system that meets that goal. We think it is certainly within the state's power to do so. No one questions the state's ability to define and to construct school districts in the state. It's a state power and a state responsibility. At least we do not question it. I think possibly some of the wealthy districts in the case do.
Mr. Scotland, before we move on to your other legal points, let me just ask you a practical question. Given the fact that this court held that the CEDs was unconstitutional, and given the fact that the voters of Texas by margin 2-1 rejected or validated the CEDs, and given the fact that the governor and the lieutenant governor have run campaigns with no new taxes, and that the speaker of the House has also said no new taxes, given the democratic pressures on our elected officials, is the reality, how do you respond to some legislators that say this is the best it's going to get?
Well, They're wrong. That's my first response. And they're wrong because they can do more with the available powers that they have. There's no reason why the legislature had to pass a bill which took hundreds of dollars a student away from poor districts and basically gave it to rich districts. There's no reason why the legislature had to create a cap on this system that is too high for the low districts to be able to reach. And that could have been done legislatively with the same amount of money. That is not our proposal. Our proposal is indeed to increase the funding. But given the amount of funding available in the system, the state could have and should have done a much more equitable and efficient job of using those resources. And I understand the political pressures you state. It's one very important issue here for us is that the state's basic argument talking about this bill at full implementation in 1995-96, to finance that will cost an extra $3 billion a year in state and local monies, according to the state statistics, an extra $1.8 billion of state money per year just to meet their promises in the bill. Given the political forces that you mentioned, I don't think that's going to happen realistically. And therefore, I would hope that as this court reviews the system, it does not allow itself to find it constitutional based on a promise of funding in 2 years, because we're very aware of those political pressures. I have spent more time than I admit at the Capitol being told about why do you ask for that when your constituents aren't for an income tax or aren't for other sources of income.
Are you, it seems to me, well, some school districts in the elementary levels provide language education. Some school districts do not, but some school districts that don't provide that ask parents that they're interested in having that available for their students and then ask the parents to pay for it outside of the taxing budgeting process. Does your view of how this ought to operate contemplate that there be a similar standard throughout the state and that but the school districts not be prohibited from accessing outside the taxing budgeting authority for extra funds to provide whatever the local district wants to do for their own kids?
That's right. We have never included in the lawsuit or objected to districts raising private money that they're using in their districts. On the first point, we have said that every district should have the funding it needs for its student body, and the state has agreed, and we certainly agree, that some students are more expensive to educate than others. So the language program you mentioned, if the school district does that, and there is a state program for children to speak other language, if that is done in the district...
No, I'm just talking about some school districts recognize the need for children to know two languages.
Yes.
We're not talking about bilingual education.
If that is done within the school and within the state curriculum, it's basically taken care of on the state's formula. State, if the district chooses to do that with private funding, that is not an issue in this lawsuit, and we have never argued that it should be.
If the state determines what a minimum education ought to be, and the norm seems to be that school districts that have access to available funds outside the taxing develop that program, would it be your position that that then becomes the minimum standard for education and that districts that don't have outside wealth also seek to have institute those programs?
I've actually never thought of that possibility. I, in my experience in Texas, that even though some districts do have private monies available, they are very minimal. They're not so much as to affect the whole system, and I don't see that happening. I think from our point of view, if the low-wealth districts could have access to the same funds that the wealthy districts have under this system, a combination of state and local funds, that would solve the issues in this lawsuit. And if those wealthy districts happen to have local taxpayers who want to contribute more, God be with them. I don't think we'd have any objection to that.
You do object, though, to local school districts taxing their constituents at a higher rate in a way that will create a disparity as between school districts.
Yes, sir. If it creates a disparity. If it doesn't create a disparity.
Private fundraising you don't have a problem with, but you contend that it's unconstitutional for local taxpayers to tax themselves at a higher rate and thus create the disparity.
No, we do not, Your Honor. We only object to that if, as they raise their taxes above some minimum level, that some districts have a greater yield than others. And that's the problem in this bill, is that above a $1.50 tax rate, some districts will have 28 times as much revenue as others. above $1.50, and that's our problem. We're not saying that no district should be allowed to go above $1.50 if everybody had completely the same yield at any tax rate. That does not occur in this bill. In Senate Bill 7, above $1.50, there's a 28-to-1 disparity. In Senate Bill 7, this year, for any district that raises taxes, there's a 28-to-1 disparity. That is what concerns us. Indeed, if the state provided a system where at any tax rate a district wished to go to, they'd be guaranteed the same yield as any other district, that does not interfere with our position in the litigation. Now, I know that that would cause tremendous concern in local districts in terms of not being able to raise their local taxes, but for the position of this litigation, if everybody's equal at $2 or everybody's equal at $1, it still meets a definition of equality. Our problem is if we're at $1.50, somebody else goes to $2 and has twice as much as we do, and we cannot possibly get that much at $2, then there's a disparity and then there's an inefficiency in the system, and that is our concern.
So you're saying it's okay if one district chooses to tax themselves more than another district, as long as all districts could, if they chose to tax themselves equally and produce the same?
And that's been the position in litigation since the very beginning.
This bill does not allow that to happen, does it?
No, it does allow that to happen.
It doesn't it cap the maximum tax rate at $1.50?
No, for several reasons. First of all, the state agrees that it allows districts to go at least 50 cents above that for new debt. It allows districts to go above that for old debt as well.
As far as maintenance and operations, though, the maximum tax rate is $1.50 per $100 evaluation, isn't it?
No, Your Honor, that's the state's position. Our position is that the Senate Bill 7 allowed districts to exceed the $1.50 with the vote of the people, that was indeed a compromise in the legislature.
Can you cite to a provision of the Education Code? And not to the bill language.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The Education Code in 20.09A is the language that says and by a vote of the people to exceed the $1.50. And that's quoted in our brief since then.
Judge McGowan seemed to take a contrary view, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
He thought that even if local voters chose to exceed the $1.50, that they could not, that would render this bill unconstitutional.
That's right. He said he found the $1.50 as an absolute cap, and he admitted that one of the reasons he did is that if he interpreted it differently, this bill would fall. It would be an unconstitutional bill.
And are you supporting Judge McGowan's view of this bill, or do you take a different
view? We take a different view. We say that the $1.50 can be exceeded by a vote of the people, and that makes the entire bill unconstitutional. Thank you.
Counsel, because you've had so many questions, would you like 5 extra minutes? Not to count against the remainder of the time.
Yes, I would, of course. I'm not trying to run away from you. I appreciate it very much. And there were, I think we've already gotten to some of the issues. I wanted to cover a few more. I've talked both about this bill in 1993, 94-94, and 94-95, as well as long-term, what we call that full implementation. Our position is that it is unconstitutional under either time period. In 93, 94, 94, 95, as I said, we have this $800 to $1,400 gap between the top and bottom percentages at present tax rates. Again, we wanted to point out, though, if districts raise their taxes, this gap gets much larger. If you have districts raising taxes 20 cents each, the wealthy districts will have a yield of $600 a weighted student, and the poor districts have a yield of $30 a weighted student. So the gap is then $500 greater than under the state plan. So the gaps in this bill are simply too great. We have a chart of what this bill looks like at a $2 tax rate, which we consider to be the, and I think the state agrees within the system, and you can see that there is a wide disparity. The bottom here is only $3,000. The scale goes from about $3,500 up to $6,200 at a $2 tax rate. The importance of both that the ultimate gap, the full gap, is more than $600, but also that the gap affects the entire system. It is not just at the top. And this shows you the districts that are roughly about the three-quarter mark, 75% level, have about $1,000 more per weighted student than the districts at the bottom. This is at a $2 tax rate under the system. So again, it is not something that just affects a small number of students very top. Once you get above $1.50, this system will affect everyone. And one more matter. All of the
let
state
me ask a Is your basic argument that the majority of the court was wrong in Edgewood 2A in saying that once basic needs have been met on substantially equal revenue for equal effort, there can be unequal supplementation, that that was wrong, or just that the way, and that the court should reverse itself, or just that this scheme is not providing the tier of adequate education at substantially equal revenues for equal effort, so that we've never kicked into a situation where unequal supplementation can be constitutionally...
I think it's closer to the second one. It's too long a question for a lawyer to say yes to, but I agree that we've never reached the efficient system. I think if we ever did, then the court's opinion would come in. I do disagree with the court's opinion. I think it should be reversed, but it's not necessary to this opinion at all that you affect Edgewood 2A, because this has never reached the plateau of an efficient system, which is where every district at any tax rate has access to the same funds as any other district. We have not attained that. We're nowhere close to that.
For the essentials of an education.
No, at any tax rate. And again, we've avoided it, and we'll continue to avoid the essentials of an education, because that ties us in both to inequality and inefficiency. Because then it will depend on some body, a state committee, deciding on what is adequate for us and allowing adequacy plus for other districts. And that is one of our main concerns. Anytime you have a committee that, again, will be subject to the political pressures that Justice Gonzalez mentioned, they're going to set the adequacy at a level that can be funded by the state. And that has been our experience in these bills, then others with the capacity to be able to exceed that level. So we've avoided that and we'll continue to avoid that, should this court allow us to, of course. Thank you very much.
Any other questions? I'm sorry. Ms. Coffin, what tax scheme exists where there would be equal revenue for equal tax effort?
If this bill did certain things. If, first of all, the $1.50 were an absolute tax limit, not allowing any excess for new debt, and taking care of old debt in another way by some other funding mechanism. Secondly, the $600 gap within the $1.50 would have to be reduced to almost nothing. And that could only be done either by additional state funds or by reducing the wealth of the wealthiest districts within the system.
Well, you don't reduce the wealth. You just have a transfer of the wealth from one district to another.
Yes.
But the disparity exists throughout the system. Income tax, any area of the state, if it's more populated, will produce more revenue for tax effort than some other part of the state, because just there's more people paying the taxes. Property taxes, a property that's more valuable than less valuable property for the same tax ever produce more revenue. At what point would you ever, in any taxing scheme, reach a point, as you say, where some district could do additional effort if it wanted to supplement its field without, in fact, affecting your equal tax effort or equal or tax revenue for equal tax effort?
Well, under the system that I mentioned, if all districts were $1.50, there's a guaranteed yield available to all districts up to $1.50, exactly the same yield, and that would create an efficient system. Then, if the legislature in the next session decided to allow some unequalized enrichment along the lines of 2A, then we'd have to come back, and then, to be honest, we'd have to argue about whether that was the type of unequalized enrichment envisioned by the court, and that would add some actual, excuse my phrase, some meat to 2A, which really didn't give us much of a specification of what they mentioned. But it could be done with existing money, and that is our argument.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is David Thompson. I'm here today on behalf of the Humble Independent School District Appellants. The Humble Independent School District Appellants is a large group consisting of 263 school districts from all areas of the state of Texas, all sizes, all wealth levels, although two-thirds of our members are below average wealth. These districts have come together for the purpose of bringing before this court their belief that the legislature in Senate Bill 7 has violated its oldest and separate and continuing constitutional duty to make suitable provision for the support of the public school system. In other words, this is not a one-time activity. It is not simply a question of setting up a system and hoping it works out. There is a continuing legislative duty on the legislature to provide suitably for the support and maintenance of that system. Our districts, which are responsible for the education of 1.3 million children, believe that that duty has not been met. In specific, we believe that there are two concrete components of that duty that are not met through Senate Bill 7. First, we believe the legislature has failed in its obligation to provide all districts, rich or poor, with reasonable resources and adequate resources to meet those legislative and regulatory mandates imposed upon those districts. And the consequence of that for those districts is extreme. Under statutes passed by the Texas legislature and enforced through the Texas Education Agency, districts are required to be accredited. That's required both in Chapter 16, the funding provisions, 16.053 of the Education Code. It's required separately in the accreditation chapter, Section 35.061. The agency looks at compliance of districts with statutory and regulatory requirements as one of its accreditation components. And if districts do not meet accreditation requirements, such that they are on accredited warned status for two or more years, they are subject to being eliminated. The Commissioner of Education has the statutory power to annex school districts that do not meet accreditation requirements to one or more neighboring districts. So there is a hammer. There is a consequence to school districts for being unable to meet the statutory and regulatory burdens laid upon them. And districts, we believe, are entitled constitutionally as well as statutorily to the resources necessary to meet those obligations. Second, the districts that I represent, in spite of their diversity, jointly agree that the legislature has unconstitutionally shifted from a state system with local supplementation to a local system with state supplementation. There is no real dispute that the state contribution to public education, although it has grown in real dollars over the last decade, and the district certainly appreciates that, in percentage terms, has declined steadily. Under Senate Bill 7, as a direct consequence of the design of the system, local property tax rates are at their highest level in real terms that they have ever been in the history of the state of Texas. And that's not an accident. The undisputed testimony at trial is to the effect that the very design of the system is intended to push local property tax rates up and then use that local revenue as the primary means of moving toward equity.
In your view, can the state shift any of the of its burden to the local school districts and local property tax?
Your Honor, as we stated in our brief, the districts that I represent are certainly willing to be a partner and to play a substantial role in funding public education. They believe, and I believe, that the district's role is to be the junior partner, and we simply want the state to be the senior partner.
And where do you find that line in the Constitution?
As this court said in Edgewood 1, in interpreting any provision of the Constitution, you look at the historical context, the people who adopted the original measure, as well as the plain language of the provision itself. We believe that a historical analysis of the origin of the phrase suitable provision clearly contemplates that this was a state duty. Remember that when that phrase was added to the Texas Constitution, when the legislature acted and when the voters of the state acted to impose that duty upon the legislature, there were no local property taxes. Local property taxes were not permitted under the state constitution at all. So that burden or that responsibility clearly refers to state revenue. Even under the present constitution, there is no requirement for local property taxes at all.
It is optional with the legislature under Article 7, Section 3, whether the legislature authorizes local districts to have property taxes. And then further, it is optional with the districts whether by a vote of the people in each community they choose to have local property taxes. We've included in our brief an historical analysis of the terms, suitable provisions, tracing them through time. Again, when we look at the historical development and the constant use of the phrases by the contemporaneous members of the legislature and other public figures who repeatedly spoke of aiding or augmenting or supplementing state effort out of local revenue, we believe the record is silent and that there is no evidence whatsoever that the Constitution contemplates a shift from the state to local districts.
I believe the state agrees with you, had you brought this case in 1876 or even 1877. But they argue that the development and amendment of Article 7, Section 3 through 100 years of amendments shows a conscious design by the people to shift more and more responsibility to local districts, and that this court has upheld various schemes whereby the state requires local government to share or assume a large part of the total obligation in meeting a state obligation and can put in carrot and stick provisions, which are essentially sticks. How do you respond to the argument that what has happened over 100 years in Section 3 changes the basic paradigm of responsibility?
We disagree with that historical analysis. There is evidence, I think our historical analysis is in the record before the court. We believe if you look at the historical development as a whole, what you've seen is a steady progression of expanding both access to local revenue, which undeniably has occurred, but more important, expanding access to state revenue. Indeed, the access to state revenue to support public education, the expansion there, Your Honor, has been much more significant than the expansion of access to local revenue.
In terms of total dollars, but not
either total dollars or source of revenue.
Well, at the time of Gilmer Aiken, it was 80% of the state funds. And at the time of the Constitution, it was 100%. So
correct.
Let's see how 43 or 49, whatever it is more.
Correct. In absolute terms, Your Honor, I would agree with that. Again, the design of the system that the legislature has put in place through Senate Bill 7 in its efforts to respond to the need for equity, unfortunately, they've chosen to do that by, in essence, confiscating the local property tax for the purpose of meeting that state obligation. The evidence is that in the 10 years of this litigation, approximately 60% of the new revenue that has come into the system has come from local property taxes, not state revenue sources. And indeed, the state has taken the position in its brief before you today that the state has no duty whatsoever to fund public education, and that this cost could be shifted completely to local property taxes if the state chose to do so. We respectfully disagree with that conclusion. We do not believe it is supported either by the plain language or the historical context of the Article 7, Section 1 obligation to make suitable provisions. This court has previously declared that those terms are susceptible to judicial interpretation and enforcement, and that's what we're asking you to do today. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Thompson, do you agree with Mr. Kaufman that determining the minimum level of education to meet the needs of the children is irrelevant in this case?
From the perspective of our clients, Your Honor, we have not taken a position on the equity issue, so I do not want to speak specifically to or rebut Mr. Kaufman's statement. Our position is we are not asking this court or any court to try to define what is adequate. We believe the legislature has already done a very detailed job of that. There are extensive requirements imposed by the legislature on all districts that regulate virtually every aspect of the public school program. All we're asking is that once the legislature defines those requirements for school districts, that there be a nexus and that the legislature provides all districts, rich or poor, with access to the revenues necessary to meet those very requirements that the legislature has determined are part of the good or accredited school system.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
The court is now ready to hear argument from Appellants Carol Farmers Branch Independent School District and others.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Bob Luna. I'm one of two speakers for the Carrollton Farmers Branch ISD et al. Group, the Coppell ISD et al. Group, the Sterling City ISD et al. Group, and the Stafford Municipal School District et al. Group. As this court has noted, and other courts as well, legislation may not violate one section of the Constitution in order to meet the requirements of another. The $280,000 limit on property wealth per weighted student required by Senate Bill 7 results in a transfer of property or money to the state or to another school district, and it offsets some of the state's financial obligations to the receiving districts. State Defendant's Exhibit 22 shows that at the time of trial, $432 million of local ad valorem tax revenues were going back into the system to help meet the state's funding obligations. Dr. Lynn Moak testified that upon full implementation of Senate Bill 7, the amount of local revenues recaptured into the system would increase to approximately $600 million per year. One witness characterized the local tax revenues being transferred as surrogate state aid.
If the state had made an additional $600 million appropriation, starting in full implementation, would you have no, would you be here? Or would your group of districts be constitutionally satisfied with
scheme? No, Your Honor. The scheme itself, we believe, is unconstitutional.
But I mean, I'm not phrasing it right. Is your only complaint based on this transfer, this mechanism of choosing one of five means to transfer wealth voluntarily or else having your district lines changed? Is that your only complaint?
That is our primary complaint, Your Honor. There are others, but that is one of the main complaints. And I think that, again, with the review of the evidence that was presented to the trial court, when Commissioner Mina was asked whether a district above the $280,000 limit had a choice about reducing its property tax revenue or property wealth, Commissioner Mina testified, well, it has a choice in that it can either do that or it can ultimately be consolidated. These districts have no meaningful discretion about whether to reduce their property value and their wealth. Senate Bill 7 is an unconstitutional state property tax in violation of Article 8, Section 1E of the Texas Constitution. This court in Edgewood 3 defined a state tax and wrote that an ad valorem tax is a state tax when it is imposed directly by the state or when the state so completely controls the levy, assessment, and disbursement of revenue, either directly or indirectly, that the authority employed is without meaningful discretion. Article 8, Section 1E prohibits the state from doing directly through the 99 local school districts what it cannot do directly, and that is levy an ad valorem tax. In this court's Edgewood 3 decision, it noted that the court did not endorse in any way the proposition that voters could be forced to choose between approval of CED taxes and school district consolidation. Senate Bill 7, nevertheless, requires that voters in 99 districts be forced to choose between approval of a reduction in property wealth per student or school district consolidation. The five options of Senate Bill 7 are voluntary consolidation, voluntary detachment, purchase of student credits, contracting for education of non-resident students, and tax-based consolidation. If a district does not successfully exercise one of those five options, the commissioner is required to detach property to reduce the district's wealth to the required level.
Is your position that school district consolidation is not a remedy available to address the orders of this court?
Not at all, Your Honor. And I think this court has addressed that issue And I think it's very clear that school district consolidation certainly is within the power of the legislature, but that power, nevertheless, is not an unlimited power, and it does certainly have limitations with it.
So the legislature could have ordered the school district consolidation directly, but it cannot, you say, do it as an alternative to a tax increase?
This court has previously held the school district authority is so broad, and because that the school districts themselves are creatures of the state, they are subject to abolition by the state, and certainly the legislature has that power, although, as I said, it's not totally unfettered and without control.
Your basic complaint is that this tax scheme is a state ad valorem tax, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
And not that one of the consequences is consolidation, because you concede that the legislature could consolidate the districts, could constitutionally do that.
Yes, Your Honor. The property is to be annexed to a receiving district by virtue of a computer program, and the evidence this was very interesting in the courtroom because it was developed by the commissioner, and where a detachment and annexation are insufficient to achieve the equalized wealth levels, consolidation is chosen by the computer program. At the trial, Commissioner Mino testified that under Senate Bill 7, one, the detachment and annexation occurs automatically according to the computer program. Neither the affected persons nor the affected districts have any voice during this involuntary process. Two, there is no consideration of the effect of the involuntary detachment and annexation on the students of either the sending or receiving districts. Three, with the elimination of the contiguity requirement, it is highly unlikely that the properties will be contiguous. Four, the receiving district to which the properties may be annexed could be up to 500 or more miles away. And five, the property could have residents today or residents in the future. Detachment could occur from properties constituting up to 80 to 90% of the value of certain districts. In addition, Sterling City's ISD trial exhibits, described on page 14 of Sterling City's brief, demonstrate some of the resulting problems, such as, one, circumstances in which improvements, for example, a gas plant, are detached and assigned to one district while the underlying land and other districts are not detached. Two, circumstances in which one interest in property, for example, a royalty interest, is detached and annexed to one district while another interest in the same property, such as a mineral working interest, is detached and annexed to a different district, while other royalties, surface, or assorted interests are not detached. And three, circumstances in which the parcels do not include all of the interest in the land. Because mandatory commissioner-ordered detachment or consolidation is based solely on economic considerations, educational reasons, such as the effects on students in either district, may not be considered. Nor may the great distances, which affect largely rural West Texas districts, be considered. Those large districts are exemplified by Pelham Andrews ISD with 1,503 square miles and bus runs of as much as 127 miles. Pelham Seminole ISD consists of 1,149 square miles with bus runs of up to 154 miles, with riding time for students of up to 1.5 hours in the morning and 1.5 hours in the afternoon. Further, if the district does not pass one of the five options, the district may not set a tax rate until the commissioner has taken his mandatory actions.
If one of the one or more of the options should not pass constitutional muster, is it your contention that the scheme must fall as a whole, or that the remaining options might survive?
It's our position that the scheme is so tied together, and that the options themselves, because of their unconstitutional nature and the way they're presented to the voters, where in fact this was not a free vote at all, and they all must fall.
The savings clause saves nothing?
Not the way the scheme is set up in the financing system of this bill, Your Honor. We believe that they're, once again, because the voters were presented with the choices and the manner in which they were presented, that because this was not a free vote as contemplated in the decisions of this court, that because of that, the whole scheme must fall.
You're arguing that what the legislature can clearly do under the Constitution, it cannot give a local district a voluntary alternative to, because it's coercive.
Yes, that's exactly right.
But they could go ahead and consolidate, but they cannot say, we won't consolidate if you're willing to do this.
That's absolutely correct. And while that may seem somewhat unusual, there's certainly very strong legal authority for that theory, the so-called unconditional conditions legal theory that the U.S. Supreme Court has addressed on several occasions.
We've never addressed it at this court.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. But
have other state courts addressed it in your research? Have you found other state courts in your research?
Not in the area of school finance, no, Your Honor.
But in other areas?
Yes.
And that unconditional conditions doctrine is what you are asking us to accept for the first time in Texas?
That's certainly what we're looking at whenever you say that can the legislature impose conditions upon on local districts that it cannot or that it could do itself. And the answer is that the legislature cannot require its citizens to surrender constitutional rights in order to receive some benefit.
Is it your position that under the structure of the Texas Constitution, children that live in property-wealthy districts are simply entitled to more money for their education than students who live in property-poor districts?
Your Honor, what we're looking at are the requirements in the Constitution. And whenever we rephrase that question in terms of the Constitution, what the Constitution and, of course, Love versus City of Dallas in addressing Article 7, Section 3 discusses is that those basically the local funds are trust funds for the local students of that school district. So to the extent that there are some inequalities within that system, the Constitution does not address that, but except through the word efficiency, as this court has already ruled.
So is the basic answer to my question yes, that under the structure of education in Texas and the Texas Constitution, you believe that students in the property wealthy districts are simply guaranteed a right to more money than students who live in property poor districts?
The only guarantee that we can find, Your Honor, is a guarantee of a basic education set out in the state policy of this, of the education code set out as the policy of the state, which every educator says is not being met. And to that extent, we go back to the basic allotment of $2,300. Everyone who testified in this trial testified that that basic allotment did not reach the state's own guarantee of a basic education. So I think to the extent that while the court and perhaps Edgewood throughout this case has wished to look at the top end of the spending, the problem really has been on the other direction in that there has never been a clear definition of what constitutes a constitutional educational system. There have been a lot of arguments along that path, but to this date there has been no constitutional or legislative definition of what constitutes a constitutional education. Certainly there are some disparities, and the question then becomes, must everyone have absolutely the same authority and the power to spend the same number of dollars for that effort? Must that be absolutely equal, or may there be some recognized differences? And to what extent may those differences exist?
A definition of a constitutional, then, by your argument, would define a minimum.
A minimum has never been defined. Certainly it should be.
So that's your argument, that it ought to provide for a minimum and set out what the minimum is.
We believe that it would be very helpful and should have been from the very beginning if we could have defined what is a constitutionally minimum system, an acceptable system, a basic educational program for schools. That would have helped a lot throughout this litigation.
I'm still not sure I understand your response to the questions that I've been asking. Let me try it another way. Is it unconstitutional to deny, or is it unconstitutional to prevent students who live in wealthier school districts from getting more money for their education than students who live in poor districts?
No.
Is it unconstitutional to do so relying on a system that's based principally on property taxes?
Yes, we believe that the property taxes obviously have been the core of this problem from the very beginning, as this court has pointed out numerous times.
So while it might be theoretically not unconstitutional, to rephrase the question yet again, so long as Texas has a system that relies in large part on property taxes, your position is that it is unconstitutional to deny students who live in rich districts more money than students who live in poor districts?
Yes, Your Honor. I think
and that, and that basic underlying philosophy is in pretty direct conflict with the whole principle of the Edgewood 1 decision, unanimous decision of this court, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the Love case, the same arguments that you're making this morning, while I'm sure they involve a great deal more legal work on your part, are in essence the same arguments that the same people advanced against Edgewood 1 in 1989, aren't they?
To a large extent, yes. Those same arguments were presented at that time, and the court simply said, of course, that position at that time was wrong. And but to the extent that what we've been trying to do since that time is find a constitutional system and adopt the ones that have been passed by the legislature has failed to do that. This court has set out in all three of its opinions different ways to do that and given various admonitions to the legislature, but the legislature has failed to pass anything which met both your admonitions and the requirements of the Constitution. Now, we're also talking about the mechanisms of the bill itself. But I think what we could say is that Section 36002 of Senate Bill 7 provides that a school district may not have a wealth per student, of course, that exceeds $280,000. Therefore, the voters were required to give up property or tax revenue. Of course, they only voted on the manner in which they were to lose it. There has been, as we noted earlier today, no constitutional amendment to legitimize that process, however. On May the 1st, 1993, 63% of the voters in Texas defeated a proposed constitutional amendment to allow redistribution of local school taxes to other school districts. 30 days after the defeat of the proposed constitutional amendment, Senate Bill 7 was signed into law. These appellants submit that Senate Bill 7 is a legislative attempt to force voters to surrender the constitutional rights established by Love versus City of Dallas in 1931. Avoiding forced detachment of property or consolidation is not just compensation, as was described by the district court. The districts have not received any commensurate benefit, but they have been forced to transfer substantial amounts of their tax base or property tax revenue. Regarding other issues, we would also urge to the court that under Article 7, Section 3, which this court has analyzed many times, that there simply is no authority for the legislature to do what it has done in Senate Bill 7. The inability of the state to require expenditure of local tax revenue outside of the district rests in part on the limitations described in Love, and in part on the limitations described in Article 3, Sections 51 and 52 of the Texas Constitution. In those sections, it states that the legislature shall have no power to authorize any county, city, town, or other political corporation or subdivision of the state to lend its credit or to grant public money to any individual, association, or corporation whatsoever. As explained by the Court of Appeals in the 1947 case of San Antonio ISD versus Board of Trustees, a city cannot donate its funds to an independent municipal corporation such as an independent school district. The Texas Constitution does not contemplate or allow the Texas legislature, as it has in Senate Bill 7, to authorize or to ratify the use of local tax revenues from one political subdivision to aid another political subdivision in lieu of needed state funds.
And again, that was an argument that was central at the same place, same case, same parties in 1989 against what this court did in Edgewood 1.
No, Your Honor. This is a brand new argument. It's never been raised before in Edgewood 1, 2, or 3.
The Love argument is the same, isn't it?
No, Your Honor. It's not at all the same. This the love argument is similar. Yes, Your Honor. But this argument here has never been raised before regarding the donation of funds.
The argument in Edgewood 1 repeated in all the other cases, isn't it essentially that if the legislature does anything direct or indirect to take $1 of property wealth out of a property wealthy district and have that accessible in any way to a property poor district, that that's unconstitutional?
That is a love argument, yes, Your Honor.
And that was an argument advanced in Edgewood 1?
Yes. Yes, it was.
While you may not agree with the Edgewood 1 opinion any more than Mr. Kaufman agrees with the court's opinion on rehearing in Edgewood 2, do you argue that Edgewood 1 should be reversed?
At this time, Your Honor, we are not making that argument.
Is it essential to your other arguments that it be reversed?
No, Your Honor, it's not. What we have addressed here are simply the mechanics, the mechanisms of how Senate Bill 7 works, offers unconstitutional options and requirements to the voters, and that there is no authorization at all under Article 7, Section 3 for this tax to begin with. Number one, there's no authorization. Number two, even with a vote, that cannot legitimize an otherwise unconstitutional tax.
I'm still curious. If the legislature had appropriated sufficient additional funds that this transfer mechanism had not been required because they had not put it in the bill, what would your constitutional argument against the rest of the bill be? You said you had other arguments besides just the love argument against this forced vote.
Yes, Your Honor. We have set out numerous, I think we have in fact 8 points of error in our brief, numerous other points, and as well as the other parties whom we represent here have numerous additional points in their briefs as well. They go far beyond just the tax aspect, the illegal state tax.
Any other questions?
From your perspective,
can the state of Texas ever achieve an efficient system under the parameters set out in Edgewood 1, relying on local property tax bases?
Your Honor, it's been very clear from Edgewood 1 that there are only 2 ways to get there. Either the state has to put in more money, or if they don't, then you have to bring the property wealth of districts down to equalize the system. And the unfortunate part about the latter is that every expert in the field of education has ever testified in this case agrees that the leveling down of the property wealthy districts does nothing to assist education and very little to assist in the financial resources of the property poor districts. There simply isn't that much money to go around from the property wealthy
districts. So the answer to my question is no, is that correct?
I'm sorry, you're going to have to repeat your question.
The question was, from your perspective, under the parameters set out in Edgewood 1, can the state of Texas ever achieve an efficient system relying primarily on local tax, property tax bases?
I think the answer is that if it's not no, it's very close to no.
Any other questions? Thank you.
I think a relative of yours gave the same answer in an earlier argument.
The court is now ready to hear arguments of Appellants Guadalupe and Margie Gutierrez.
May it please the court, Mr. Parker, with this argument on behalf of Appellants Guadalupe and Margie Gutierrez.
May it please. May it please the court. You've heard from the school districts of the state, the property rich and the property poor. My name is Alan Parker of the Texas Justice Foundation. I represent Lupita and Vanessa Gutierrez, their mother Margie Gutierrez, who's with us today,
and, what
and
is
the other
low-income families.
What is the Texas Justice Foundation?
It's a nonprofit public interest litigation firm similar to MALDEF and other interests like that, supported entirely by private donations.
It's affiliated with the Texas Public Policy Foundation?
It's an initiative of the Texas Public Policy Foundation. It's a separate 501c3 corporation.
It's Mr. Tex Lazar's group.
Mr. Tex Lazar was previously, prior to January 1983, president of the Texas Public Policy Foundation. He's never been associated with the Texas Justice Foundation in any way. You have heard from the trustees of the school districts. I speak for the beneficiaries of that trust, the children of the state of Texas. According to the undisputed facts of our petition, which must be taken as true for this appeal since we were dismissed on special exceptions in the court below, the trustees are doing a pathetic job of educating the children of this state. And it's time to give a measure of control to the beneficiaries of the trust. This is not just a case to decide, but a historic opportunity to bring liberty to the 3.5 million children of the state of Texas and to embrace a principle of liberty and competition that will do more to improve the public schools of this state than any other reform can possibly accomplish. It's time to take the focus off of money alone and put it on results and the way we organize our schools. Procedurally, the poor families alleged that Senate Bill 7 was unconstitutional because it was inefficient, unsuitable, and produced a general diffusion of ignorance rather than knowledge. The state specially accepted, the court granted the special exceptions, we stood on our pleadings, and the claim was dismissed. We have two basic arguments based on the Edgewood decisions of this court and the true meaning of the 1876 constitutional provisions. Both are independent reasons and both are sufficient for reversal of the district court's decision. One argument is basically historical. What did the citizens of 1876 want? Did they want parent-controlled education or state-controlled education? The answer is very clear. They rejected radical Reconstruction, and they wanted parental control of education, and they designed a constitution to give them that. The second argument is factual, and as the poor children were denied a trial that the government entities received in this case, those facts are taken as true. If the legislature is required to design an efficient system, what rational person would choose a government monopoly? Not the people of 1876, who stated in their Bill of Rights that perpetuities and monopolies were contrary to the genius of a free people and should not be allowed. If approximately 75% of the low-income children in this state are failing minimum competency tests, which is the truth, how can that system be producing a general diffusion of knowledge? In the Edgewood Independent School District, 80 to 90% of the low-income children are failing minimum competency tests. That is not a system of a general diffusion of knowledge. That is not an efficient system. The state and the district court have argued that you have no power to change that, that that's a political question for the legislature, and that the only thing efficiency means is equal tax revenue for equal tax effort. That's not what the people of this state mean when they hear the words efficiency. It's not what was meant in 1876. I don't believe it's what this court meant. In fact, this court has made it clear on several occasions, explicitly in its prior Edgewood decisions, that it was focusing on money because that was the only issue that was brought before the court, and the only arguments were equity finance issues.
You cited favorably in your brief to our decision in Edgewood 1 on the issue of not avoiding this on the political question doctrine.
Yes, sir.
And you think that that was a correct writing in Edgewood 1?
Yes, Your Honor. We basically are not opposed to equal financing. Edgewood 1 was a good beginning. Now that this court has said that it is for this court to determine whether the constitutional minimums are being met, then this court cannot back away from that and say, well, if you have one definition of efficiency, you can come into court and get a trial. But if you have another definition of efficiency using the exact same language, the exact same provision of the Constitution, you don't get a trial.
So on the basic principle of Edgewood 1, insofar as it went,
you disagree with Mr. Luna.
Yes, Your Honor. We're not here asking for Edgewood 1 to be overruled. The party that's asking that is the state. On the political question, they want the Edgewood 1 decision, which said it is the court's responsibility, to be overruled in effect, or they do argue limiting just the tax effort for tax revenue. But there's no way that you can limit it to that based on the language of the Constitution. You have to let people have a trial to determine what efficiency is. And as this court said in Edgewood 1, if the system is not efficient or not suitable, then the legislature has not discharged its constitutional duty, and it is our duty to say so. We're not asking for the broad type of relief that you've already granted in Edgewood 1, an injunction to shut down the entire school system of the state of Texas. We're asking on behalf of three families to take their share of the education dollars and perhaps less. For an example, the Gutierrez case, they only want to spend about $1,500 a year. Edgewood School District spends $5,000 a year on each student. They want to take less than that.
You're asking this court to reinstate.
Exactly right, Your Honor. At this point, the procedural thing you can do is reverse the special exceptions and allow us to have a trial on the merits.
Did your special exceptions come after a failure to reamend?
No, Your Honor, there's no, we're not complaining of not giving an opportunity to, of not having been given opportunity to replead. The judge felt, granted the special exceptions because he felt it was a political question. And therefore, there really was no, it's not our facts that were in dispute. So we think he properly dismissed if this court's going to rule it's a political question.
In other words, if we felt a summary judgment was appropriate for the state on your pleading, then we should affirm what the judge is doing. If we felt that you raised sufficient issues to either legally or factually to have a trial on the merits, then in your opinion we should reverse.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely. And our facts are undisputed. Only 20% of the poor children in Edgewood can pass minimum competency tests. And the one of the important facts, which is admitted as true for the purpose of this appeal, is that the system of political control cannot reform itself. And we are going to demonstrate that at trial through a tremendous battery of national experts. The original Edgewood trial, I believe, took 6 weeks. This lawsuit in October lasted several weeks. We only asked for 2 weeks to put on our case, and the judge denied us that opportunity. We believe the children of the state are more important than the governmental entities. It's not just a question of shifting money around among governmental entities. It's a question of how are the schools organized. We will show how the principle of competition, rather than the political control model, will force improvement in the schools, whether this court does anything or the legislature does anything, because it empowers the people to make the decisions. And this is the least disruptive reform to good schools. Nothing happens at good schools. But at a bad school, the parents would have the opportunity to go to a better school for their children. We believe we have both the factual arguments, which I've mentioned, and the historical arguments, Your Honor. Basically, the very first system adopted by this state was a voucher system. Any group of parents could go out and start it. Keep in mind also there was no compulsory education in 1876, so that no child could be forced to go to a bad school. Our children are being forced to go to schools where the games are so bad, it either be put in jail by the government for truancy or be beaten up into submission to join a gang at the school. And we have pled that, and the state's only response is, it's not our responsibility as a state to provide safe schools.
When was the last time, your research shows that the state paid money for one of its citizens, one of its children, to go to a for-profit school?
About 1908, Your Honor. So it lasted for about, 40 years? About 40 years the system lasted. And what's happened, Your Honor, is the political control model has gradually taken away that right. Well-to-do parents have choice. The legislators have choice. And it's the poor that our Constitution, keep in mind, we're only asking for this right for low-income children, because all of the members of the Texas Constitutional Convention and the people at the time felt the poor should be the prime beneficiaries of an education system, not the ones who get the dregs. Even equalizing the wealth among property districts does not protect all the poor children, because some of them live in pockets of poor neighborhoods in wealth-balanced districts that are big enough. This is the only remedy that would protect all the children of the poor throughout the state, whatever district they live in, and give them a remedy that the Constitution clearly intended for them to have.
The amicus brief filed by Representatives Grusendorf and Wilson and others comport with your views entirely, or do you separate from their views?
Your Honor, due to the short briefing schedule on this, I believe it was filed Friday, and I have not read their brief, so I can't say if it comports entirely with it. I was aware of the general thrust being that efficiency requires something other than a command centralized system. We agree with that 100%.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from Appellate Somerset ISD and others.
May it please the court, Mr. Maloney, has an argument on behalf of the Appellate Somerset ISD and others.
May it please the court, I represent Somerset Independent School District and 10 other school districts who, for convenience, I will refer to as the Somerset plaintiffs. These are 11 diverse school districts, diverse both in their geographic location, financially, and most other ways. In fact, they are united only, as far as I know, by the fact that they are subjected to the CED distribution rule of the Commissioner of Education, as a result of which all of the 11 Somerset plaintiffs will lose funds. Indeed, in excess funds alone, the Somerset plaintiffs will lose more than, or just under $4 million. They will lose that much or more delinquent taxes. And as a result of the rearrangement of the excess funds and delinquent taxes, state aid is then also rearranged, and so they will consequently lose considerable state aid as well. It is for this reason that the Somerset plaintiffs have challenged the rule of the Commissioner of Education, which pertains to the distribution of CED, both excess funds and delinquent taxes. This case was tried after case, we were granted a separate trial, although we were not severed as requested from the main Edgewood case, and it was tried on agreed stipulation of facts. All facts, therefore, are stipulated. There is no factual dispute, and indeed, principally, this case presents a question of statutory interpretation, which is, of course, a question of law. Let me briefly touch upon what this rule does. The rule is several pages. I set it out in the appendix of the brief. Of course, it's in the record. It's also in the Texas record. But basically, the rule does two things. It puts in place a formula which, when applied to excess funds and delinquent taxes held by the CEDs in the winding up process, sets a specific amount of those funds that is to go to each of the component school districts within that CED. What that formula did was to drive the excess funds and delinquent taxes to the low wealth and low tax effort districts within the CEDs that had excess funds and had delinquent taxes. By contrast, we need to look at the statute upon which the rule was based, or upon which the authority for the promulgation of the rule was based, and that is Section 415 of Senate Bill 7. I think it's instructive to look at what that statute did not do to give us some insight into what it actually did do. That statute, number one, says nothing and does not direct the commissioner to do equity. It does not say do whatever you want to do with these excess and delinquent funds. nor does it in any way set a standard for determining the amount of the CED funds that are to go from the CED to the component school districts of that CED. And ultimately, neither does the statute grant any broad grant of authority to deal in a plenary manner with education financing, or anything of that nature. What the statute does say, and again, it's a matter of statutory construction, what the statute does say is different with regard to excess funds and delinquent tax. So let me diverge a little bit, talk first about excess funds, because that was the first thing dealt with in Section 415. In Subdivision A, basically, the legislature provided that on August 31, the CEDs were to transfer to the component school districts funds, those are the excess funds that were on hand at that time, in the manner provided by the rule of the Commissioner of Education. You will note the omission of the word amount from that statute. As this court noted in the case of Cameron v. Terrell and Garrett, an omission is as purposeful and important in a statute as is the inclusion of a word. And that is particularly true where, in this case, in the very next provisions, in subsections B and C, the statute talks about both the manner and amount. In subdivision A, it specifies only the manner, however. So with respect to the excess funds, the Commissioner of Education had no authority whatsoever by the express terms of the statutes, both by what was included and what was admitted, had no authority whatsoever to set the amount by rule, as he clearly did by the rule he promulgated. Clearly, then, this part of the statute, this part of the Commissioner's rule, as it deals with the excess funds, is contrary to Section 415 and is therefore inappropriate and invalid. With respect to delinquent taxes, we have a different section situation because, as I indicated, subsection B of subsection B of Section 415 of Senate Bill 7 does refer to both manner and amount, and it talks about assets. Delinquent taxes are a part of the assets other than funds that are transferred by that second subdivision. But in that subdivision, it provides nowhere any means to determine, for the commissioner to determine in promulgating a rule, how to determine what amount is supposed to go from the invalidated CEDs back to the component school districts. So that gives rise to a serious question of an unconstitutional delegation of legislative authority because it is standardless. But before we reach that question, we have to do the best we can, as I understand the authority of this court, in order to uphold that statute rather than strike it down on those constitutional grounds. And I believe that, in fact, the statute does provide standards by reference, implicit reference, and by looking at the statute as a whole, as again, we must do. Specifically, in the court, the state in its brief, and the trial court in its opinion, indicated that Section 16.001 of the Education Code does provide the standard. But we have to look then at what that standard is. And we agree that that provision of the Education Code does provide the standard. But the standard provided in that section is that fundamentally is Section 16.001 in subsection B provides that the public school finance system shall adhere to a standard of neutrality which provides substantially equal access to similar revenue per student at similar tax effort. What that means in essence is that the higher your tax effort, the higher revenues you ought to be generating. It is undisputed from the stipulated facts, specifically at transcript page 1677, that what the commissioner intended to do, what he attempted to do in promulgating the rule, and what we agree and I believe it is indisputable that he did do, was just the reverse. He gave, transferred or drove the funds from the former CEDs not to those high tax effort districts, but rather to the low tax effort districts. Again, directly contrary to the statutory authority provided by Section 415 of Senate Bill 7. Again, in both instances, because of this failure to abide by the statute, in fact, because of the fact that the rule directly contradicts the statute, the rule, therefore, is invalid, and that distribution, the distributions of both excess funds and delinquent taxes under that rule are likewise invalid. Let me speak to just one other issue that the state, both the trial court, the district court, and the state have brought forward, and that's this question of, well, these are state funds. You, Somerset plaintiffs, wouldn't get them anyways, and although it's never been said expressly, it seems to me to raise something of a standing question. You know, we haven't got anything to complain about because we don't get this money anyway. It's state funds, and it would escheat back to the state. That whole argument is predicated on this court's opinion in Edgewood 3, in which the court held that the CED tax was a state property tax. As occurred, though, the court deferred that ruling, allowed the CEDs to continue operation, continue to, in effect, remain into effect for some 2 years until September 1, 1993. Again, back to subsection A of Section 415 of Senate Bill 7, it provided that the funds were to be transferred by the CEDs to the component school districts on August 31, 1993. That's the day before that deferral of the unconstitutionality ruling of this court came into place. And therefore, those funds were the CED's funds until August 31. They were transferred to the component school districts by the very terms of the statute itself, the legislative directive. At no time did those funds ever become state funds. So, they obviously cannot escheat to the state because they were never state funds in the first place. They were CED funds. They were component school district funds. With respect to delinquent taxes, because the delinquent taxes under the statute provided that they were to be transferred on September 1, there's a little bit different situation. I see my time has expired. If there are no questions, I thank the court for the opportunity to argue. We ask that the judgment of the trial court be reversed.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court will now take a brief recess and will return to hear argument from appellees and rebuttal arguments.